Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it's time for what, for many of you, has become your favorite segment of the week, which is our Q&A with Layla. Layla Mutin is our Hoffman Center nutritionist. She is duly certified as a registered dietitian. She also holds a master's degree in nutrition. Welcome, Layla.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good, thanks. So that picture of us recording our podcast last week, wearing our winter clothing inside with a muffler and those Nanook of the North hats,
yes.
We got a lot of likes on Facebook.
Oh, good.
So, you have achieved celebrity status now on Facebook. This week, we've got a lot of questions. By the way, the way to get questions to us is via radioprogram@AOL.com. One word, radioprogram@AOL.com. State your question. And we can't answer all the questions, but we will select questions to be answered via our podcasts. And I'll announce that we're looking for phone calls for the first hour of my weekend radio program. So those of you who wish to get your question answered possibly on the air, if you care to share with us your phone number where you'll be on a Saturday from noon to 1 p.m., give us a phone number, and I'll give it to my producer of the radio program, and we will call you, and we will put you on the air live so that I can answer your question. But if you prefer to remain more anonymous and you want to just email us your question, don't include your phone number, just radioprogram@AOL.com. We'll endeavor to answer as many questions as we can during our weekly Q&A with Layla. So I noticed as I saw you in the office today, you seemed pretty happy because you had before and after pictures of one of your patients.
Yes.
Actually, a patient that I didn't see because you have patients of your own that see you simply for nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
So without outing this patient, because he may want to remain anonymous, what's the deal? Because I saw the before and after pictures, and they were dramatic.
Oh, yes. And this is a gentleman who is in his mid to late 20s. And what's happened is he was very insulin resistant, obese. I put him on a low carb diet. I gave him the supplementation and everything. And he lost 80 pounds. He lost 80 pounds over the course of about 10 months. 10 months, which
wow.
Is absolutely wonderful.
And he looks like he's on his way. He's not quite there yet.
Yes, he's on his way.
But he looks really like happy and fit, and he looked so bloated and heavy. 80 pounds. So how did you do it?
Well, he basically had to commit, first of all. He knew he had to do something about his weight, which was the biggest problem. And he was worried about risk factors for heart disease and everything. So I basically...
Because, I will disclose that I treat Dad, and mm-hmm. Dad has some cardiovascular risk factors. So he was mm-hmm. concerned. He sent his son for a consultation because he said, hey, we got to do something about this before you get in trouble.
Right, right, right. So he was being proactive on his part, which is very, very good. And so we talked about, what happens when we eat a certain way. If we're eating too many carbohydrates, what contributes to insulin resistance. Some people just want to know what to eat. This was not him. He wanted to know mechanisms and everything. And I love when patients ask us that. Why is this working that way and not this way? And why can't I eat this or that or the other thing? And I love telling them on a little bit of a biochemistry level without getting too dry about it, what's actually going on in their body, in their metabolism.
I think it's a little bit like that old adage, give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day. Teach a man how to fish and he'll eat for life.
Yeah.
Because now he has the tools mm-hmm. and the intellectual framework to evaluate the foods, and he has an understanding of what he's doing, and that's powerful. It's not just simply saying, "Hey, what do I eat?" It's like give me the do's and the don'ts, some sheet like a diet sheet that tells you this is what is on the diet sheet. Here's your breakfast. Here's your lunch. Here's your dinner. Here's your prepackaged meal. That then you don't really have engagement with the process.
Exactly. And the other thing about understand what's going on metabolically is then you understand that this is a way to eat for life. It's not necessarily a diet which is implied to be something temporary. We don't want it to be temporary. You have to understand that even after you've lost the weight, your metabolism will still work a certain way. And if we fall into our old eating habits again, the whole process starts all over again. The whole cycle starts all over again, and weight gain can occur again. Risk factors may increase again, and so forth. So he had an aha moment.
What is he eating? What is he eating though?
Well, he's eating meat, he's eating chicken, fish, he's eating vegetables, all the non-starchy vegetables.
Right, so he got
he's
away
having
from,
some fruit.
This is basically
he got off the pizza and the french fries and the donut and the Danish and the McDonald's and so forth. He got off all of that crap, even the diet soda.
Right.
And so forth. He stopped having too much coffee with a lot of artificial sweetener in it, which is no good.
Which revved his appetite.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. So
he's even curtailed his alcohol intake.
Great.
You know, it's one thing to have a margarita,
right.
But it's another thing to come home and have two fingers of vodka and that's all.
Yeah, you know, look, there's a reason they serve so much booze in restaurants is, A, the profit margin on booze is much higher than it is on a steak,
true.
Right? Because a steak is very expensive for them to buy and booze is cheap for them to buy and the markup is enormous. You know, when you buy a bottle of wine in a wine store, you know, it's $12. Yeah. In a restaurant, it's $35.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is that it promotes appetite. You know,
it does.
So they always rush it to your side. They say, would you like a drink? Because
yeah.
they know that you're going to loosen your inhibitions, you're going to relax, your stomach is going to open up, and voila. Yeah.
That first drink will cause, if you're already not even hungry yet, but you know it's dinner time, that first drink is actually going to cause a little bit of hypoglycemia, therefore making us hungrier once our meal comes.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to think about it. Had I not had this much to drink, would I have eaten this much? So
with that in mind, here's a headline from a London tabloid. I think it's the Telegraph. Headline, it's time for the werewolf diet. Eating to lunar calendar like Madonna and Demi Moore claims to shed 6 pounds in one day.
I feel like we should have a howl.
Ow! I mean, we don't need sound effects. I can do it. You know, eating to the lunar calendar, they say that Demi Moore and Madonna have both used the diet. Boy, that's high praise because I'm telling you, forget the sign. If Demi Moore, and she's looking good.
She is.
And Madonna, and she looks like bony.
Yeah.
I mean, she looks a little too, you know. She works out a lot, and she's looking a little, you know, gaunt, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
If they're, you know, so I want a piece of that, right? Because of, you know, it says a little known diet is gaining popularity, with celebrities choosing to follow the werewolf diet. It is also known as the lunar diet.
Oh.
So here's the idea behind it. It is based on the idea that the moon affects the water in our bodies very much in the way that it affects the tides. And indeed, you know, perhaps it does. There is a lunar pull, and some women actually menstruate in cycle with the moon.
That's true.
Especially, you know, maybe if you go out camping, you know, you start to see the moon, and it, like, starts to affect your hormones. In modern days, we lose this. So
that's why women are no longer menstruating all at the same time?
Yeah, maybe. Well, I'll tell you one thing is, I know when it's a full moon here in Manhattan because, you bump into people and they're acting crazy and they're pouring out of the bars and I go, it must be a full moon. Or, alternatively, if it's a Saturday and it's a full moon, you know, some of the calls I get on the program, they can be pretty strange. And I say to my engineer, hey, it's a full moon. But so this is what the website says. Consuming more fluids will call on the power of the moon, and it will allow your body to lose its excess water. This flushes out the toxins that accumulate in the body due to unhealthy foods and provides a detoxing effect that will strengthen your immune system.
Okay, I'm going to drink more water next full moon.
Next full moon, right?
Yeah.
You had a chance to look at this. What is the scientific basis for this?
There is actually no scientific basis for this.
Right. Except perhaps for the drink more water part. That's not a bad
That's always a good thing, to drink more water. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's a headline.
How about the horoscope diet?
What is that?
Well, I'm just making it up.
Oh.
How about a diet that, you know, a diet for a Sagittarian, a diet for a Libra, a diet for... How about that?
Okay.
Wait, you and I, we're going to write the book.
We'll write the book.
It's going to make zillions.
There we go.
Okay.
Since I'm a Pisces, does that mean I eat fish? More fish than anything?
Definitely.
Okay.
Wait, isn't there one that's a Capricorn? Do they get to eat more sheep?
I don't know.
That's the one with
and
the
Taurus?
Horse.
Taurus
is a bull. They get
Taurus
to eat more beef.
And what do you get to eat? You're a Libra. Scales?
That's scales or metal. Well, maybe fish with scales? How about, well, I don't know if we can keep.
I don't think that's a great.
Well, look, I'll call my agent. I'll see if that's something that they want to, you know, if they want to do. But okay, so let's get to questions. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we have a lot of listener questions this week.
Mm-hmm. I have one.
Yeah.
From Lawrence. Lawrence writes, Dr. Hoffman, what are your thoughts about marijuana becoming nationalized, he says.
You know,
maybe he means legalized.
You know what? I think that there's too much government intrusion, that I think marijuana should remain a private enterprise and the government shouldn't nationalize marijuana. Maybe that's what he had in mind.
Maybe that's what he meant.
I think Lawrence is a smart guy, and I think that's what he means. I don't think he means marijuana being legalized, and he wrote the wrong word there. Mm. I think what he means is that it seems like there's sort of a government regulation or a government takeover, government taxation over the marijuana industry. And I think that's his comment. You know, look, I'm not going to go there politically because, you know, this is an argument that I'm kind of ambivalent about. Because let's just say that, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of the British invasion. Do you know that next week, 50 years ago, was when the Beatles first appeared on Ed Sullivan?
I don't even know if you
were around at that time, because you may have been too young, but I was a kid,
uh-huh.
and I was watching Ed Sullivan,
uh-huh.
and this crazy group of mop tops went on, and I saw the girls screaming, and I said, wow, this is an amazing phenomenon. So, you know, so talk about the rock and roll generation, the pot generation. Mm-hmm. Been there, done that. I have some, shall we say, firsthand experience, you know, in that realm. No longer does that make me ineligible to run for president, it seems, right?
Because I think
we've broken that barrier.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say that regardless of this argument about should it be legalized or not, you know, I think that when something is decriminalized, it sends a message that it's okay to use.
Mm.
And that may be okay for probably the vast majority of young people who use it. I think it's really bad for really young kids to use it because I think that this is a point where the brain is in a critical phase of development.
Yeah.
And being stoned is not a good place to be when you're 11, 12, 13, 14 years of age. Maybe, you know, when you reach the age of where they allow people to drink, 18, 21.
Sure.
The only problem is, you know, we know that the drinking age is 18 or 21 now in New York. Yeah, mm-hmm. good luck. The smoking age is 21 in New York. Good mm-hmm. luck with that.
Yeah.
Cigarettes are legal, so kids are going to get them. And you know, now that marijuana is legal, kids are going to have more access to marijuana. And, you know, I remember when I was in high school, we wanted to get alcohol. The drinking age was 18 then in California. Now it's 21. We would just find someone who, you know, was 18, and you know, we just, you know, pay him to,
exactly.
to
that's
get us,
still going
to
on.
Get us a six pack. I mean, that's a traditional thing to
yeah.
do. So
yeah.
that they're going to circumvent that. There is evidence that marijuana increases the rate at which schizophrenia can appear. I think there are some.
Wow.
Yeah, there some kids are vulnerable due to genetic or environmental reasons towards schizophrenia, and that might just mm-hmm. put them over the edge. Is it a gateway drug? I think for the vast majority of kids it's not, but the idea that they're doing something illegal or illicit may entice them to go for like a stronger high.
That's true.
It certainly was the case, you know, in the 60s generation where pot was, you know, the first thing you tried and then it was next to it was mescaline, LSD, you know, whatever.
Everybody still thinks they're invincible at that age. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. So,
fear is
you know,
way less.
You know, I got to say that it's opening the doors to some problems. Also, frankly, you're inhaling mm-hmm. Burnt vegetable material. And I don't think they've had enough long-term studies to determine that that's okay for your lungs.
It has to be carcinogenic to some
seriously,
degree.
I mean, it's like, look, if you stand over a campfire and inhale, you know, that's not good either. If you stand too close to a barbecue and inhale,
mm-hmm.
so even though maybe there's no nicotine or, you know, cigarette tars mm-hmm. in the marijuana, you know, God knows what that's doing to your. It gets into your blood vessels. It gets into your brain. It certainly gets into your lungs. So, you know, it's not so great. It really isn't so great.
And long-term use of it is terrible for our organ systems eventually. And the other thing is, if you're boys who are going to start smoking pot that early are wreaking havoc on their testosterone.
Yes, I think that really does that. I've seen cases of testicular cancer in pot smokers.
Wow.
I've seen cases of gynecomastia in pot smokers, enlarged breast tissue. I think there may be certain hormonal effects. I'm concerned over the effects on driving. Because, you know, drunk driving is one thing, is they can, you know, now their kids are pretty scared of being arrested for drunk driving because they have the breathalyzer test. And if you don't pass, they take your car away and, you know, it's like a big, big deal now. Actually, much more of a deal than when I was a teenager, because it was then a lot of kids were driving around drunk and killing each other left and right and killing themselves and running over innocent people. And but they really clamped down on that. So now you see more kids, you know, when they go to party venues, they get limousines or taxis to take them back and forth. Mm-hmm. But with pot, it's kind of hard to detect.
Yeah.
So you can be stoned out of your gourd, and it affects your reflexes. It sort of creates sort of a time-lapse phenomenon where, you know, it 5 seconds may elapse, but it feels like a minute. You know, and clearly that's going to change your judgment, your coordination, your ability to negotiate highways, your risk-taking mechanisms are going to be affected.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that ain't good.
Driving while intoxicated or DUI, driving under the influence, that could be the influence of anything, marijuana, alcohol, pain meds.
But they don't
anything.
Have they don't have good tests for that, because there's no breathalyzer for marijuana. There's a blood test, but then you can do urine tests.
Mm-hmm.
They're not as readily available, because actually cops are not empowered to draw your blood.
That's right.
In order to
test your reflexes, really.
Sometimes they take you to a hospital to get a blood test, you know, administered if they suspect you of having DUI, and if you refuse to do a breathalyzer. Different laws in different states, but with pot, it's different. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of downsides. I'm going to assume that the question is about marijuana being legalized, not nationalized. I mean, look, the one thing about the penalties for having a small amount of pot, I think it's terrible when kids are incarcerated.
And that's wrong. Underage drinking, they're not incarcerated.
And there's a double standard, because if you're a rich white kid from the suburbs and you get busted, you know, you call daddy, daddy's lawyer, you know, gets on the phone, schmoozes with the police, and you're off. And if you're a poor minority kid and they nab you, they're, you know, it's going to be on your record. You won't be able to get a job.
Right.
You know, it could consign you to a lifetime of permanent underclass, you know, and then, you know, going into prison is a gateway drug to crime, you know, and to a life of criminality and poverty.
Absolutely.
So that part of it, all right, so enough on that. We got another question.
Okay. We do. This is from Susan. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Robert Lustig, who wrote Fat Chance, said in a radio interview, insoluble fiber is destroyed by the blades of a Vitamix when preparing smoothies. She says, this doesn't make sense to me. I don't see how the benefits of fiber in celery or chard, for example, would be reduced by whipping them in a Vitamix. What's your opinion? I agree. We're talking about insoluble fiber here.
Okay, so let's distinguish.
Yeah.
Let's give people a basic primer on fiber.
Insoluble fiber is the fiber that's not digested by our gut. Soluble fiber is actually very good for gelling together all the contents of our gut and very good for regularity. Both are very good for bowel regularity.
Soluble
fiber would be the flesh of an apple, and insoluble fiber would be the skin of the apple.
Okay.
So, you know, pectin that's in the flesh of a fruit would be the insoluble. Would be the soluble. I'm sorry.
Soluble means it dissolves.
It dissolves, exactly.
And insoluble doesn't dissolve.
It doesn't dissolve.
So the insoluble, the soluble forms a gel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a gel-like thing.
Exactly.
And that's a colloidal thing that's actually what Jell-O is.
But the insoluble, listen.
Jell-O is made of pectin, which is soluble fiber.
Right, right. So the insoluble, listen, what the Vitamix is doing with its blades, we're doing with our teeth when we're chewing. when we're masticating.
Right.
That's what we're taught. We tend to break it down that way. Whether it's destroyed or not, listen, anything we're putting into a blender and making a smoothie out of, we are pretty much pre-digesting that food for us. I am always a fan, those of you who know me, I'm always a fan of you eating your food rather than making a smoothie out of everything. There are appropriate times for that. If you want to get more vegetable into you
right.
and you've eaten enough and you want to get a green drink, that's fine. But if you're just relying on that, not really, because it's still pre-digested. It might have a little bit of a higher glycemic index in my estimation. Well, that's a possibility.
It alters transit. You know, so people who drink their breakfast as a smoothie, it hits them a lot faster mm-hmm. than if they have a breakfast that is solid food.
Mm-hmm.
So they grab the smoothie, or it used to be this, the fashion was, you know, have carnation instant breakfast.
I used to do that.
You know, you just, you know, because what, you don't have a lot of time in the morning, so you like make us up, you know, shake it up, put it in a blender, boom, drink it down. It's like the modern meal. It's, you have it in a minute. But all those nutrients kind of very quickly hit you because there's no fiber to slow their absorption.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Oh, you just reminded me, when I was 13, it was very in vogue. Me and my girlfriends would have carnation instant breakfast for breakfast. It was a very,
It's like astronaut food.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, remember Tang?
Tang, right.
Yeah.
Okay. It was like better living through chemistry. Well, hopefully, you know, we're turning the corner on that era, you know, that we grew up in. All right. I actually have one that is, this is a little self-congratulatory. Because it's a letter, it's a really nice email to us from Diane, who is a patient.
Mm-hmm.
She writes to us, diagnosed with MS several years ago, my husband suggested I see you. Thank you for a job well done. I've been taking the supplements you have advised, eliminated the foods I am allergic to, and I have been on the paleo diet way before it became mainstream. So we were ahead of the curve on recommending that for autoimmune conditions.
Mm-hmm.
She writes, exercise is a large part of my life, including yoga, Pilates, and cardio. Never felt better. Here's the kicker. My MS buddies can't believe I have the same disease as they have. Signed, Diane. She writes, yes, I am also a nurse. So here's a health professional who did not go the conventional route in management and is doing really well. I really love to treat MS patients, particularly we get them early. We can really alter the course of their MS.
Absolutely.
And now there's, I had a great interview with, what is her name, the expert on MS, Dr. Walls.
Dr. Walls,
yes.
Terry Walls.
Terry Walls, yeah. W-A-H-L-S. Go to drhoffman.com/podcast and scroll down. A couple of months ago, I did a podcast with her, and she's doing this kind of work. She herself is a physician who suffered MS
mm-hmm.
and wasn't satisfied with the conventional treatment, and now she advocates a paleo diet that's a custom paleo diet for MS, and it's very nice. She has a very nice website.
And gotten better.
With the use of certain supplements.
Yeah.
We don't quite agree on the supplements, but that's okay. We agree on a
on
preponderance
the food.
Of things, on the diet. But MS, I really wish the medical establishment would embrace this approach to MS because patients would do a lot better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Vitamin D and whatnot, lots of omega-3 fatty acids.
I have one, Dr. Hoffman. This is from Paula. And she writes, dear Dr. Hoffman, Layla, thank you for your program. And Dr. Hoffman, I've listened for years, utilizing much of your advice when applicable to my circumstances. Without exaggeration, I could say that you have helped me tremendously. I have had lupus for 39 years. I am 60. 17 years ago, I took control of my health since I was unhappy with the focus on medications alone from the medical community. I adopted a mainly paleo way of eating. I lost and have kept off 78 pounds.
Wow.
I lift weights, sprint, and walk for exercise. I also take a variety of supplements. And now here we're coming upon Paula's question. My vitamin D level recently tested at 66. My doctor said it was too high and that I was risking calcification of my blood vessels with a vitamin D level above 40. I wear a lot of sunscreen due to the lupus, so I take 10,000 IU D3 in the winter daily, and I take 5,000 IU in the summer. Would you comment upon whether or not there is medical research pointing to calcification of blood vessels being caused by vitamin D in my range? Thank you. You are a medical knight in shining armor.
Well, that's very, very kind. Thank you for that. But, you know, I'll say that this letter rather dismays me because it betrays a really poor understanding of what vitamin D does and the potential for toxicity with vitamin D.
Yeah.
Because if we're talking about the same scale of measure, we're talking the usual way that we measure vitamin D, up to 100 is safe. 100 to 125 is the, you know, yellow light caution zone, and above 125 toxicity can occur. It's an old theory that vitamin D produces calcifications in the arteries.
Is it actually a theory?
Well, I think what they did once with rabbits is they gave them super high doses of vitamin D. This is in a physiology experiment like 50 or 75 years ago. And they gave them a high-fat diet, and they induced atherosclerosis. And they thought, well, you know, it's the vitamin D in the fat that's causing it. You know, but that's a rabbit. Rabbits don't eat, you know,
They don't eat that way.
They don't eat fat.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't eat animal fat. I mean, rabbits are not carnivores, and they, you know, there's unnatural levels of vitamin D. And so, yeah, they demonstrated that. But that's a very, that's not easily extrapolatable to people. Vitamin D, in fact, has been shown to somewhat protect against cardiovascular disease. It's certainly useful for congestive heart failure. It helps the pumping action of the heart, but it also may prevent atherosclerosis. And,
absolutely. Well, you know, by being the bus to deliver the calcium to the bones.
Right.
Along with vitamin K. But her level, you know, at 66, I think is perfect.
It's a perfect level. And,
yeah.
You know, it betrays, unfortunately, a misunderstanding. But see, what I worry about is if I don't know something, I really try to say, look, I just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And too many doctors not familiar with vitamins and nutrition tell patients stuff, scary stuff sometimes, discourage them from taking vitamins based on incomplete knowledge. Now, I have tremendous respect for my physician colleagues because in the areas in which they specialize, they do amazing things. The surgeons, the orthopedists, the endocrinologists, the gastroenterologists, the people who treat, you know, HIV and rheumatologists, they have to keep abreast of so many new findings, and it keeps changing. And they're also under the constant threat of malpractice because if they goof, then they get sued.
Yeah.
And, you know, now with the, you know, new insurance reviews and things like that, then they don't get paid if they don't do the right. It's very, very hard. So, you know, there's precious little time to stay abreast of important nutritional developments. That is what I do. I specialize in that. I spend every waking moment from the time I open my eyes in the morning to practically, you know, when I close my eyes at night, you know, trying to read the latest nutrition information for my patients, also for this podcast and for articles that I write. So this is my passion. This is what I do. It's a specialization. So, you know, it's the problem is not only does this doctor not know, but this doctor is discouraging an MS patient who really could benefit from, is it, no, a lupus patient, excuse
yeah,
me.
A lupus patient.
A lupus with an autoimmune condition who really could benefit from vitamin D because it seems to attenuate the autoimmune response. In other words, it kind of acts as a little bit of a, it blunts the over-exuberant immune system in rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. Rheumatologists know this. And so studies have shown that in MS, for example, 10,000 to 15,000 of vitamin D, which is a very high dose, and you have to be careful, is helpful. And that's why some studies showing small doses of vitamin D don't make a difference in MS. Well, they aren't using enough. I don't have a problem with a level of 66. That's well within the range that we accept at the Poplar Center.
I think that's perfect.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What I have a problem with is the supposedly authoritative opinion that this doctor renders based on misinformation.
Exactly. And to her detriment, unfortunately. So, Paula, continue doing what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she's on the right track. All right. We talked about plantar fasciitis in a previous podcast, and somebody sent in some additional information. So I'm going to pass it along. It's not a question. It's a comment. I had plantar fasciitis, this person writes. A year and a half ago, I tried everything, ice, the sock, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, physical therapy, topical steroid patch. None of it worked. My pain was severe. I could barely walk. a colleague told me of an manual soft tissue therapy called Bowen work, B-O-W-E-N work, which she had used for her plantar fasciitis. It sounded too good to be true. I went to one session. Within hours, I was pain-free. Placebo? Maybe. But I don't think so, because that's
pretty painful.
Yeah, that's a condition that's very real inflammatory pain. So maybe it's a form of trigger point therapy. This person says, and no, I have no connection with, nor do I gain from this therapy. So I'm just passing this along to listeners.
Bowen work.
For plantar fasciitis. And, I think that's all I have on that.
Okay.
We have questions from Kristen.
Yes.
Kristen, she herself is an RD.
Yes.
And
yes. Breaking into the world of integrative medicine. Yes.
She said,
a wonderful job.
She says, I've been thoroughly enjoying your podcast with Dr. H. I listen to all the podcasts multiple times. Oh, my goodness. How do you survive that? That's rough. Take it easy, Kristen. And I had asked you how – she's talking to you here,
yeah.
Layla.
Yeah.
I had asked you, Layla, how you were able to retain so much knowledge in regard to the various nutritional elements that play such an enormous role in our health. Your answer, constant reinforcement.
Once you learn something, you learn it. You've learned it. You know it.
And we stay in practice, and we meet challenging situations all the time. We have to apply this knowledge. And we do a heck of a lot of reading. We stay abreast of it. Okay, so needless to say, you, Dr. Hoffman, and my iPhone spent a lot of quality time together. So let's see if we can handle some of her questions. You often talk about the thyroid and the causes of hypothyroidism. Can you elaborate a little on how to detect an iodine deficiency, the best way to test for it, and what your recommendations might be in the case of a deficiency? So,
iodine deficiency. The iodine urine test that we do is a good way to detect iodine deficiency. A deficiency of iodine can cause hypothyroid. Too much iodine can also cause hypothyroid. Iodine deficiency can also cause or may exacerbate fibrocystic breasts. To my knowledge, that could be something.
Actually, I'll go one step further, is that even in patients who seem to have adequate iodine, we can use iodine therapeutically at higher doses. So that's a condition where, you know, even a person seems to have adequate levels, we'll use it therapeutically. Another example of that would be, say we're using fish oil for arthritis and someone whose blood test may show they have adequate levels of EPA. We're using it at high doses to suppress inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
Here we'd use iodine to suppress the nodularity and pain of fibrocystic breast disease. And besides, it has a anti-cancer effect. Iodine's a funny thing, though. There's a lot of controversy in the world of complementary and alternative medicine about iodine. There's some real iodine fanatics, people who propose we give very high doses of iodine to people. And their theory is that we have iodine-deficient diets because a lot of food is refined, and we're on low-sodium diets, and we're not getting balanced salt that has iodine in it. So they recommend sea salt that has additional iodine added because sea salt doesn't have much iodine, really.
Mm-hmm.
They also suggest that the chlorine and bromine in our diets, and to some extent the fluoride, compete with the iodine and deprive our thyroid of...
Yeah, and the chlorine in our water.
Chlorine in our water, brominated bakery products.
Mm-hmm.
Bromine is used in bakery products to a high extent. And then, of course, fluoride. We get a lot of fluoride. So that this may interfere with iodine metabolism, so therefore we need more.
Right.
Now, other people point out that you got to go cautious on iodine because you can get, as you say, you can either suppress the thyroid with iodine too much or you can send it into overdrive. And so I have to say that I'm a bit of a middle-of-the-road where I recognize the importance of iodine, but I'm a little cautious about dosing high.
Well, that's why the testing is a good idea. And there are some dietary sources of iodine.
Yeah.
Seafood, anything coming from the sea, onions, kelp.
Well, particularly shellfish.
Seaweed, shellfish, all of that. Besides iodized salt, dairy, because dairy equipment is cleaned with an iodine solution.
That's interesting,
So anybody having dairy is getting some iodine.
Well, they used to say that people who ate a lot at McDonald's would get a lot of iodine because they used iodine solution to clean the grills.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was, I guess, okay if you had a deficiency, but if you had too mm-hmm. much, maybe not so good.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's a controversial area. Do you have a question for anybody else? Because I want to get a question for somebody else.
No, you can go ahead.
Okay, so she has a second question.
Yes.
Some of my private clients have difficulty with the taste of extra virgin coconut oil, while others absolutely love it. For those who may require an alternative, what are your thoughts on hemp oil and palm, not kernel oil?
Mm-hmm.
Will they provide the same benefits?
I don't believe that hemp oil and palm oil have the same amount of lauric acid, saturated fat, which is what's really beneficial.
That's the antiviral,
antifungal,
antibacterial thing.
As well as I'm not sure of the amount of capric acid, which is related to caprylic acid,
right,
which can be an antifungal
right,
as well to some degree. I think the benefits of coconut oil are more... what I would say, actually, cook with it. If you can't handle taking a teaspoon of it or anything like that, but maybe she's talking about people who are cooking with it.
What's...
Extra virgin will have more of a coconut flavor as opposed to the refined coconut
right,
oil. Sometimes some people have to go a little bit more refined or just use it in particular recipes that tolerate that flavor of coconut
right,
better.
If you're making like Italian food, you don't really want a coconut oil
right,
flavor.
Right,
you know,
right,
it's
right,
like that. You want olive oil.
Yeah, but if you're making shellfish and garlic, like scallops with garlic,
yeah,
it looks amazing.
You can cook it at high temperatures.
Yes,
too. Yeah.
Yes. If you're making a rice pilaf or something like that, that may be amenable to coconut
yes,
oil.
Yeah.
Or I would just say, you know, suck it up a little bit, hold your nose, take a half a teaspoon
right,
here and there when you can.
Right. But
or put it in a smoothie.
Put
it
in a smoothie. I love
in
it.
Your
in
your Vitamix.
Smoothie. You know, I put it in the Vitamix. No, what I do is sometimes part of the thing with a smoothie is that it's all carbohydrates. There
mm-hmm.
is, it's protein and carbohydrates, but there's no fat. So there's a tendency for it to be rather rapidly absorbed. It hits you too quickly. There's no satiety value
yeah,
to it.
Yeah.
With protein, there's a certain satiety value. With carbs, it's the opposite. Carbs may stoke your appetite or give you hypoglycemia.
Sure.
But when you put fat in with anything, a fattier meal
mm-hmm.
has slower transit time. It stays in the stomach longer, and it's absorbed more slowly. So what I do is I take 2 tablespoons of coconut oil. I put it into my smoothie, sometimes with a half of an avocado. That sounds kind of weird.
Very nice. No, it's nice and creamy.
Yeah, it makes it very creamy.
Yeah.
And it's a really thick consistency. I mean, a straw will stand up in it.
Yeah.
And I'll use some fresh frozen berries or something. It cools it off, you know, so it's
mm-hmm.
a cool temperature. And maybe throw some flaxseed in it
sure,
as well to get some fiber, some fresh ground flaxseed. And, you know, that coconut flavor is dynamite with fruit and with whey powder, which is sort of, you know, vaguely vanilla-like.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can throw some vanilla in if you want to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's see here. Oh, she actually has a third question. I'd asked Dr. Hoffman this question several months ago on Facebook. If you were a woman, what supplements would you include in your daily regimen?
If you were a woman,
mm-hmm.
if you were a woman, Layla, what would you do? what is
she
implying here?
She was asking you. No. Okay, let's assume a healthy woman. I guess it depends on the stages of life.
Okay.
If we're talking about a middle-aged woman, definitely a good formulated multi, with or without iron, depending on if she's premenopausal, postmenopausal, anything like that. I think fish oil is indicated for most people. And really kind of tweaking according to their lab results. You know, what is, how is DHEA? What is the lipid panel like? What are any of those things? But I think overall, something like that, I think also a great benefit anyway for most people is CoQ10, is carnitine as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's good protection. Certainly vitamin D.
Yeah, thanks.
And vitamin D, we need to test twice a year.
Right.
To do it correctly. That's really it. So vitamin D should be tested. I think magnesium as well, because we're all low on magnesium.
And especially stressed people are low on magnesium.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and B vitamins as well.
Right.
So there's really a kind of a slew of things depending on the situation.
You know, I resist a little bit the average, you know, like if you
yeah.
are the average person, and that's, I think, what our whole practice is
about. The average
is
person is obese.
Well, that's
so
true.
So what do we do? You
right.
know, yeah.
Well, the average person is obese, but I would also say that we have a very individualized practice here, and... You know, these days there's so much information out there, you can just basically, you know, go on a website and say, well, they claim this, they claim that, I'll put it together for myself. But it's a little bit like what I have to do if I get a little extra money, I don't know what the heck to do with it. I've got to talk to a financial person because I can be taken for a ride. I mean, and, you know, these days it's such an area of expertise. Or if there's a legal problem, what am I going to do? I'm going to go on, you know, one of those, lawyer.com or what's that online site?
I forget. LegalZoom?
LegalZoom.com. You know, yeah. Well, that's great if you want to, you know, have like a simple, you know.
A simple will drawn up.
You know, but, you know, if it gets complicated, you know, I think that that's, so I argue for individualized nutrition.
Yeah.
It's based on history, you know, like what's going on with you, what's your heredity like, then there's certain blood tests that can reveal things. Do you have any medical conditions or how do you feel?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that's
yeah.
what we do.
Absolutely. And that's integrative and functional medicine. That's essentially it. It has to be unique because we all have a unique biochemistry.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the notion of like the one-a-day yeah. men's vitamin, the one-a-day women's vitamin. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit, you know, bastardizing that concept.
That's true. So rock on, Kristen.
Rock on, Kristen. Thank you so much for your kind
yeah.
words. Do we have time for another one? This is because
yes.
we're going a little long, but I want to address this one. This one's from Cheryl, who's one of my Facebook friends. My best friend, 49, works at a hospital in Toms River, New Jersey, giving radiation treatments to cancer patients. Because she is aware that all radiation causes harm to healthy tissue, she has never had a mammogram. Her insurance company, the hospital, informed her that if she did not get a mammogram, she would have to pay an increase in premium of $30 a month. She is being fined for not radiating her breasts. So Cheryl is saying, you know, I mean, she wants us to comment on that situation. Now,
That is absolutely scary.
It's very scary, and, you know, you could blame Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, but actually it's not so much about that one piece of legislation. It's the direction that medicine is taking in this country, which is towards monolithic recommendations that are actually being coerced on people. I think that the, quote, Affordable Care Act is imposing more of that, you know, that, you know, one-size-fits-all policies and everybody gets certain types of screenings and doctors are told that these are the tests you can do and these are the tests you can't do and this is an operation that's suitable and this is not suitable in the name of, quote, cost containment and uniformity and equity, you know, that everybody yeah. should get equal treatment. But when it comes to mammograms, it is controversial, to say the least. And I don't know the answer because I'm not here to say women don't even think about getting a mammogram. It's bad because it's a little bit like the situation with getting your PSA checked as a man. There is strong evidence that the number of women you need to screen in order to save one life from breast cancer is exceedingly high. It may be as high as 2,000 women need to be screened. That means 1,999 women get screened unnecessarily to save one life. Now, that one life is precious, no question. But if it were inconsequential to the 1,999 other women, I would say, let's do it for that one woman. But it is consequential because you're getting a dose of radiation. You're getting a big dose of apprehension because I know
yes.
for women this is a big deal. You're also getting sometimes false positive findings, which necessitate additional testing and apprehension and often surgery, biopsies, and getting needles stuck in your breast, stereotactic needles and all that stuff.
Right.
That is pretty unpleasant. I wouldn't want certain parts of my anatomy to be subjected to that. It's a bummer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's highly controversial
yeah.
because some organizations claim that every woman from 40 to 49 must get an annual mammogram. Other organizations, other countries do not mandate that.
That's right. The WHO, the World Health Organization, says 50 and above. I believe we're the only country that says 40.
And then
40.
When can you stop?
Yes.
Should 85-year-old women be reporting for their 55th or whatever their 45th mammogram that they started?
Well, if the radiation hasn't killed them already or caused some other
right.
thing like low thyroid
right.
or who knows what, okay. But
there are actually some studies that support the idea that less frequent mammography is associated with less breast cancer. And that's disconcerting because it suggests that the mammography itself may be associated with increasing the risk of breast cancer.
Well, the thing is that there's overdiagnosis now of breast cancer, which is playing into that statistical survival rate.
Yes, exactly. We're more women are surviving breast cancer, and then they have all these women that they're wearing the pink ribbons. They say, I'm a breast cancer survivor. But maybe you had the type of breast cancer that you would happily go to the grave with at 111.
Exactly. Now, because of it's been more digitized than it was at its inception 30 years ago, mammography, they're finding more microscopic things. But these microscopic things may go away on their own, number one.
It has been shown.
Right. Or nothing may happen, or they may not take your life until you're 103 or 93 or something like that. These are microscopic cancers that you would ordinarily do nothing about. So really, as a screening tool, not great, but as a diagnostic tool, just like they said in the New York Times article that we were discussing earlier, as a diagnostic tool, you feel something wrong, your doctor feels something wrong, go get a mammogram.
Absolutely.
Go get it checked out.
Yeah.
But as a screening tool for everybody 40 and above. And
I wish I knew the answer, because there is no question that in some instances mammograms can be life-saving. But one argument also is that there are breast cancers of three types. One type, discovered by mammogram, it doesn't matter, because that's the cancer that never would have grown or might have regressed and might not have changed, and you would have died of another cause.
Mm-hmm.
Especially an older woman may die of something else before that becomes a problem.
Yeah.
The other type is so deadly that even tiny when you find it, or by the time you find it, no matter what you do, the current treatments are not going to make a difference.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunately the case, is we don't have perfect treatments for breast cancer, as much as we, you know, have advances. And I think that there are advances. I think women are being saved. But in some cases, the mammogram is inconsequential. It's, you know, just not saving the life. And then in between are maybe, you know, 10, 15, 20%, maybe up to 30% of women where the mammogram finding is consequential. It's going to change their fate. It's going to extend their life, save their life potentially, because the cancer was discovered early. But that's the problem. We cannot distinguish, based on a mammogram, which cancer is going to be dangerous and which cancer is going to be, you know, relatively slow in its growth.
Right.
And
right.
What we need are better imaging tests, maybe scans of various kinds, or maybe blood tests that they're working very hard to find that will actually help us discriminate between the more dangerous findings and the more benign findings and help us decide, you know, should we really get in there and do something or just leave it alone?
That's true. I just want to mention something. Women, especially with dense breasts, they say that they have it's a risk factor. It's a higher risk factor for breast cancer. But the reason for that is they can't see anything with dense breasts. So they want you to come back more often.
So
and
they're
going
to find the cancer.
So they're going to poke you and prod you until they probably find something.
That's a good point.
Which is completely disconcerting.
That's right. Also, I just read an article, and it's remarkable, which shows that taking omega-3 fatty acids reduces your breast density. You take it one step further, you say, well, does it prevent breast cancer? And that's controversial. There are some studies that show it may have a preventive effect on breast cancer, but other studies do not demonstrate that. But, hey, if you have less dense breasts, they'll leave you alone. They'll say, oh, we don't have to go for that,
take your fish oil, everybody.
Take your fish oil. All right. I think that's pretty much covers it for this week. Do we have any announcements to make?
Our upcoming lecture, The War on Natural Medicine, that will be Wednesday, February 26th at 6 p.m. You want to reserve your seat, so please call our office to do that, 212-779-1744. These lectures are at the Hoffman Center on the third floor at 776 6th Avenue.
All right, and listen to Intelligent Medicine on Saturdays. And if you want to listen to the first hour, some of you who are in the New York City area, you only hear the second hour from 1 to 2. You want to listen to the noon to 1 hour, you can wait till Monday. We post the podcasts up at drhoffman.com/podcasts. Or you can listen live. Go to the WOR website and find my picture. And you will find a link where you can listen live to the program via your computer. So, well, thank you very much. You've done yeoman service once again, Layla.
Thanks, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.
You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce, and so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the intelligent medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or, alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.